Happy birthday, Robbie Tyron.
Puberty is when you grow into your adult body, usually between 8 and 14 years old. All that growing brings changes that may make you feel scared, confused, excited, or all of the above. It's all good. You're just maturing. Puberty is a process that lasts years, hits differently for everybody, and can last till you're around 20. So how do the changes show up? You may get pimples, mostly on your face, but on your body too. Hair. The hair you have on your arms and legs may get thicker and darker, and you'll likely grow hair in new places, like your face, armpits, chest, and pubic area. Stretch marks are common too, a sign of your adult body taking shape. Physical changes, from body odor to growth spurts, are just part of the puberty story. All kinds of new feelings may come on too, like crushes and being sexually turned on. It's super common to feel like your emotions suddenly turn on and off, sad, angry, or irritated. No matter how you're feeling about all these changes to your body, remember that puberty is a normal part of growing up, and knowing what to expect can help to make it feel a lot less weird or stressful. Want to learn more? Go to PlannedParenthood.org/teens.
That's right, and you are listening to WUSB Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM, 107.3 FM, and over the internet at WUSB.FM. And now, as part of the 6-7 time slot on Tuesdays, it's time for another edition of Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel here. Kyle over there.
Hi, E.
Welcome back.
I feel welcome.
Did I say something funny before? All these people rolling on the floor. I don't know. I just announced the show like I usually do. Did I mess something up? I don't know. I don't know. Kids today, I do not understand. yes, so welcome back. We are here live in the studio, which hasn't happened in a while.
It was probably nothing. Yeah, live.
Yes, us being away wasn't nothing, but what I said was probably nothing. Yes.
Whatever is going on with them.
Nobody knows.
I'm sure they'll
nobody
be okay.
Nobody knows. No, but it's just crazy these days. We both had some train adventures. We had train adventures together. We had train adventures separately. We went to a No Kings rally on Saturday. We have a lot of people ask after a No Kings rally, okay, so what's next? Well, we have some answers as to what might be next. We're going to get into that in a little bit. But, you know, I touched upon the train thing last week. excuse me. And it's something that we do every now and then, take long-distance trains. By the way, I don't know if you heard this. There's a major announcement yesterday that might have been overlooked by many people. They are expanding Metro North, part of the MTA, from its northernmost point, Poughkeepsie, all the way to Albany. Yes, you'll be able to take a Metro North train from Grand Central Station all the way up to our state's capital in Albany. And that's I did not see that coming. It's going to be cheaper than Amtrak, probably slower than Amtrak, definitely slower than Amtrak, but it's an option for people who, might not want to be on a crowded Amtrak train and might want to spend a little bit less. But the really cool thing about that is that now with the integrated ticket system, you could theoretically go over to the Port Jefferson train station and buy a ticket to Albany next spring when they start this service. That would be cool. That would be damn cool to have one ticket that got you all the way up there. I'm not sure about the connection, because I think they're only doing one train a day, one round trip a day. Hopefully they do more than that.
Well, for that matter, if you end up in Albany, you could pay for one ticket back to that said ferry. So
there's no ferry. There's no ferry. You said ferry.
To the connection in the other direction.
Yes.
You know, if you end up in Albany, which a lot of people do.
We ended up in Albany.
We've had issues like that. Mm-hmm. And if you needed to get an alternate route, I'm assuming the tracks are different in some way. But regardless, there's options going both directions.
I think they're the same tracks. I'm pretty sure that they didn't build more tracks. So I'm pretty sure they're the same tracks. But something else they're doing is they're reopening the Albany to Boston route on Amtrak. That was actually closed, and it was replaced by buses because of something. I don't know what. But you could hop on a train at Port Jefferson or Stony Brook and make your way up to Albany via Metro North and then hop across the platform onto an Amtrak train and take that to Boston. That would be kind of cool. Again, I don't know the connections. They probably have it so that they don't match in any way, and that's almost impossible to do. Just like, you know, we went to New Haven to check out the pizza, or however you say it there.
Appease.
That's how you're supposed to say it? A-P-I-Z-Z-A. Is how they spell it. Yeah, we went to three different places, and we came back by Metro North again in Connecticut, got off at Bridgeport, walked over to see the ferry just leaving. and that's not a good connection. Of course, we were the only people doing it, but still, you can have a much better connection than that. So hopefully, you know, it's a good step. It's something that I think is overdue. It's an expansion where I didn't see an expansion coming, and it's fun. You know, theoretically, you could take a trip from Montauk on a single ticket, Montauk to Albany. That's probably the longest you could possibly take a trip on the MTA consecutive. Again, the connections, who knows? But yeah, so we did long distance travel. The two of us rode from Seattle to Chicago, and then you rode from Chicago down to Florida, while I was riding from Chicago to New York at the same time. That was kind of cool. But the thing with the Amtrak long distance trains is that if you have a sleeper, whether it's a roomette or a room, you get three meals a day, and that's covered. But the thing is, you always wind up in the dining car sitting across from either one or two strangers. And what happens there is magic, because you wind up talking to people. It's not like on a plane where you just kind of ignore the person next to you. these are people opposite, sitting opposite you, and you have a window where America is passing by, and there is almost always a story of one sort or another. I talked about a couple of them last week. The woman from North Dakota who was studying Native American culture and kind of looking to empower those voices more, as we are doing as well. I think I mentioned the Undertaker that I met. I met an Undertaker. I had a long conversation with this guy before I found out he was an Undertaker, because I just asked what he did, and he said, you know, if I tell you that, you'll know my family buries bodies everywhere, which is literally true. So I guessed that immediately. But did you have any good encounters on your train?
I sure did. There were situations where I was walking in to have a meal, and I was offered to sit anywhere, but it felt wrong to not join someone that was already seated and didn't have company. But I asked anyway, you know, can I join you? And I was offered the seat and invited. And one meal I sat having breakfast with a much older woman than even I think my grandma was. I don't know. She was really delightful, though, and having her breakfast already.
Mm-hmm.
And I started my breakfast with her and shared about the whole system. That it was amazing how much it helped her get around, talking about things like mobility and when to move around, you know, waiting for the train to stop is a little easier. And that whole kind of camaraderie, the experience of the whole system to do whatever you're trying to do, it's really nice to be sharing those experiences. And there's some common observations about all of that. And I had another great conversation with a retired preacher. I believe a Methodist preacher.
And oh, wow.
It was a very, very pleasant and encouraging conversation. We talked a lot about different things going on in the culture, and politics, of course, came up a little bit, and talked even about some of the No Kings actions. And
you talked about No Kings with a preacher.
Yeah, yeah. This person was and talking about family and the collision of all of these things and caring for people and that kind of thing. Just, it was very, very sweet to make acquaintance with someone so quickly in that situation where you're total strangers, but confiding a little bit and having the conversation become better for it and taking on a direction and a new meaning, and even staying in touch with people and sharing some of the things or elaborating on some of the things. In fact, I exchanged information with this person and was, really, really, pleased to have like made a friend and supported them and encouraged them just as they were. They were with me in that situation. I mean, whenever you're able to make a connection, I think it's really worthwhile to see where it goes and there's a mutual benefit. You never know how people will see you, how it will enrich your life. And
how did it come about that they were a former preacher? Did you just ask what they did, or did they mention it? Were they wearing some kind of garb?
I think the conversation sort of went around in talking about culture and talking about how religion was sort of overflowing or bleeding into politics or being used in politics. And I think faith and spirituality is something that people talk about with ease if they're particularly well versed in it, or, you know, it is literally their vocation. But I was talking a lot too about vocation and how people define and find these things manifesting in different ways in their lives, and that, mm-hmm. you know, you may not be devout in the sense that you show up on time for mass necessarily, which a lot of people maybe couldn't maintain the rigors of in their lives. As mm-hmm. But maybe in on the contrary, quite readily able to incorporate practices that they find spiritually meaningful, but they're already doing or that they engage in sort of independently of that organized
right.
faith. So I really find that interesting. And we've talked a lot about monasticism and the different Orthodox traditions where and even in Buddhism and across faiths, across many faiths, that there is the sort of finding of spirituality in your vocation and in all things. So that conjured up a really authentic conversation about background and how we sort of think about those things in the conversation with a stranger, so that you can have a baseline understanding of like what a person's background might be and what they might be familiar with. And I think that is that's good, because it remaining a mystery, you know, even if someone isn't necessarily faithful, they may have a background that instructed that mm-hmm. that was quite religious, and we all have, you know, some of those exposure to those, some of those things in our upbringing.
So. Well, I mean, it's just such a magical moment where you get to have this conversation with somebody from a completely different world, and have mutual respect and be able to share stories. I mean, I'll bet they came out of that conversation respecting you as much as you respected them. And that's not something you get every day, especially not these days.
Yeah, it was very affirming to talk to someone that heard things in what you were saying and really got you. And I was just blown away. I was blown away to like share and be encouraged.
Mm-hmm. And that's the magic of trains
and conversation and,
yes.
and being brave enough to join other strangers and not recluding. So reclusive.
It's a good unused word.
Retreating into a device of some sort.
Right, right.
Give it a try. Talking to people, you might find someone that you know, fall in love with, or someone that you disagree with but respect. You know, those are all part of taking the leap in being out in the world.
Disagreeing and respecting, I think, those are the goals, really, because you don't want to agree with people on everything, and you want to find a way to disagree but also respect their opinion and be respected by them. Then you have conversation, then you have progress, then you have, you know, actual changing of minds and development and things like that. You know, I had an interesting experience. This was in the New York State section. I think we were between Buffalo and Albany, heading towards Manhattan. And I sat with this couple, and, you know, they weren't talking. They weren't saying a word. And, you know, here I am sitting opposite two people. And, you know, in a situation like that, I've mentioned this, you know, on an airplane, I don't talk to anybody. On trains, I will even start the conversation, which, you know, if you know me, is unheard of. And, you know, finally, the opportunity, they were both staring at their devices. The guy was staring at an iPad. The woman was staring at a phone. I just, you know, asked them where they were heading, and they told me, I forget where they were headed, Schenectady or Poughkeepsie or something like that. Then we just started talking about, you know, the journey and trains. I think, yeah, we had stopped at that point, and, there was supposedly a freight train in front of us. We were just discussing delays and just the allure of train travel. And the guy, you know, it turned out to be somebody who was more enthusiastic than he appeared. I thought he was just, you know, a businessman or something, but he actually was really into trains. Mapping the journey. And he said, you know, it's too bad there isn't something that allows me to see, you know, all the trains. And I happened to have a website that did exactly that. And when I showed him that website, it was like a little kid on Christmas Day. he was just so excited. And it was amazing that, you know, you can just share something basic like that and make people really, really happy. So, It was fun talking to them for, you know, about 45 minutes or so, and it's better than just, you know, sitting silently opposite someone. And that's what you get when you travel cross country and you have a dining car and you're able to exchange these back and forth, not only pleasantries, but insights. And I look forward to it. I always look forward to that. Okay, so now we have other important things to talk about. including what happened on Saturday. But first, you know, I want to just this piece came in. In fact, I saw several pieces like this overnight where the word demolition was used multiple times. I don't know if you've seen any of these stories, Kyle. But apparently the east wing of the White House is being demolished. And if you look at the headlines, and they are still up, and there's, you know, I saw six or eight of them, and they all had the word demolished, and they all had the word Trump's ballroom. Yeah, the east wing of the White House is being demolished for Trump's ballroom. None of them said, construction at the White House or a new ballroom sees the light of day at in Washington, D.C., nothing like that. They were clear to label it Trump's ballroom and the fact that it's demolition, because those are the ugly truths. The facade of the East Wing of the White House came crumbling down on Monday as construction began on President Trump's 90,000-square-foot ballroom, a project that will transform one of the most recognizable buildings in the world and nearly double the size of the existing structure. Having already changed so much about the way Washington works, he is increasingly changing the way Washington looks. Now, the thing is, he kind of promised that he wasn't going to do that. He said back in July, the construction of the ballroom won't interfere with the current building. And he's demolishing the east wing of the White House. Are we really going to just sit back and let him literally demolish the White House? Because that is what this idiot is doing.
Yes.
It just seems like, you know, we're just content to watch.
No, let him do it.
Let him do what? He's not a 3-year-old that's going to burn himself out and take
fine.
A nap.
It's fine.
He's a nearly 80-year-old maniac who is going to do so much destruction that, I don't know, it might be worth just to start a new country and stop trying to fix this one. Ugh. Well, anyway, you know, a lot of people agree with the sentiments I'm expressing. I found that out on Saturday. Of course, I already knew that. And that's when 7 million people marched all over the country, 2,700-plus events. One of them was local here in Port Jefferson Station. Kyle and I attended that one. I have to say, there had to be well over 1,000 people at that one. Of course, we weren't there the whole time, so people were coming and going the whole time. It was very much like the one in June, except I think bigger, significantly bigger. And I say that because there were people further down Route 347 than there were the first time.
Yeah, I would say like 25, maybe 50% bigger.
But yeah, well, then maybe 1,500.
It crossed over the block where it hadn't before.
Well, the thing is, as opposed to last time, I think last time there were 5 counter-protesters on the other side of the street. This time there were none. There were no counter-protesters. But there were these people that would drive by in their pickup trucks and blow train horns. You know the kind of people I'm talking about. They blow train horns, and it scares the bejesus out of you. And that's the intent. That's the intent, is to scare you. That is all they had. A couple other people were pickup trucks, revving their engines as they drove past the crowd.
There was a screaming Tesla guy.
A screaming Tesla. I don't know what that means, but fine. Lunatics. People
another
who,
person that, like, had signs and stuff. Sorry.
Well, these are the guys that are in power. These are the guys that are getting everything they want. And yet they are so angry all the time.
I really felt that acutely. You had kind of been, just mentioning that along the way as a lot of the politics has played out this mm-hmm. year. But it really struck me that this is not the behavior of winners.
No. No, it's definitely not.
It's really, like, unrecognizable. This guy was, like, screaming at the top of his lungs. He looks like one of these, like, gym rat guys driving a Tesla and screaming at a couple, like, just an older couple walking to their car, walking away. They weren't even protesting. It's like he had made his rounds around the block and couldn't shut it off when he was, like, hitting the side street to loop back around or something. But this couple was just minding their own business. I mean, yeah, clearly they had come from the action that was on the public rights of way there. along the street, but it's just the extraordinary rage. It struck me as like this, these are people that will not be satisfied. Like, and what's your threshold? When do you know it's fixed if you can't help yourself but be that angry at nothing? I don't think there's any appeasing you. Nothing will satisfy you.
Well, it's fixed when there's no opposition, when there's nobody to counter what it is you want. And then, you know, it's not over then either, because then you turn on your own. And you see that all the time with the Trump administration. They turn on themselves. Somebody who is, you know, in deep with the regime is an outcast 6 months later. Look at John Bolton. These things are common in these kinds of societies. But yeah, we saw things like that. We saw, you know, people who, and it was really less than five people total that we saw acting like that. I mean, occasionally somebody would go by with a massive flag and a MAGA poster or something. And that's fine, you know, drive by. But, the weird thing is the train horn could almost be interpreted as support because everybody was blowing their horns. And this was a really big horn. Didn't scare anybody. It was just was kind of annoying and just told us that you're kind of a dumbass. Point taken, and everybody else moved on.
I had the same feeling about some of the louder vehicles. You can't really tell if there's no sign or anything like that. Like, is that support? Or is that some kind of antagonistic or intimidating?
Yeah, they should have had a sign. Because, you know, to this day, I'm not sure. Maybe they were supporting us.
There were a bunch of motorcycles that went by, and you don't know. Motorcycles
sound like that all the time, whether they're left-wing or right-wing.
And
so,
their horns aren't particularly loud, so that may be a way of registering.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, of the people who were there, and I think this is something important. They're the ones that count because they count a lot more than the handful that don't support them. You know, what I mean by that is there were, let's say, 1,500 people there at that corner, and there were five people that were vocally against them. That doesn't mean that one side is equal to the other side. And sometimes, with quote-unquote journalists, they feel the need to talk to the people on one side and then talk to the people on the other side and give them 50-50. And that just paints a really inaccurate picture of what is actually happening. You think that, you know, there were an equal amount of people on each side, and that is not the case. The story is what happened on that corner with the 1,500 people. Those are the people to talk to. And yeah, if you want to mention that there is a small group of people that were against it, fine, but you don't give them the same amount of attention because they were nowhere near the same amount of people. So let's focus on numbers, you know, like elections are supposed to do, and see what so many people are upset about, hear what they have to say. And boy, they were interesting people. They were all kinds, you know, old, young. Yeah, I'd like to see more young people there, but they certainly were, you know, it wasn't a lack of young people, just they want to see more. I want to see more of my friends there, you know. Honestly, I'm just going through the list of friends in my head, and I don't know if I know anybody else who went to one of these things. And these are all people who strongly support what the No Kings rallies are for, are all about. And I wondered to myself, why? Why aren't you going? Why aren't you showing up? I don't want to hear this negativity that, oh, it's not going to do any good, because that's one step away from not voting because it's not going to make a difference. And then when you do that, you cede control of everything to the other side, and you wind up losing everything, and you have no one to blame but yourself.
That's so accurate. It's the people that are most lamenting and most upset that deserve a chance to maybe hear from other people and be out in the fresh air, like elbow to elbow, or looking at funny signs, like just hilarious statements and sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
That's an antidote. That's a way to maybe feel less at a loss or less despair about the state of politics, so
yeah,
that those people don't go. It's really tragic. I mean, unfortunate, because I felt that way too. But showing up, you've got to show up. Show up for yourself. Show up for your neighborhood. Show up for the people that can't. You got to like realize that it's not the end, but it's a part of the process. And getting the numbers up, getting the ideas out there, thanking people for showing up. I was handing some stuff out, but also thanking people.
Yes.
Because they would thank me for literature or whatever you're doing to spread the message and share. They're thanking you. Well, I'm thanking them for showing up and being being active at all, because mm-hmm. it isn't necessarily something everybody can do readily or thinks of. And that got a little confusing. Some people were like, thanks for organizing this. I was like, I didn't organize anything.
We were just handing out a few things, and all of a sudden, you did a good job organizing it. No, we didn't organize this. And that's kind of what the right wing thinks, too, is that it's all very organized. These are just people coming together, you know, and showing up at an appointed time and bringing their signs and seeing what they have in common and just, you know, making a big fuss. And I'll tell you, it feels great when you do that. You feel so empowered. You know that, you know, it's not hopeless, that there are many more people, you know, waiting to get involved. 7 million people. It's the largest march, coordinated a series of marches in U.S. history. Yeah, that's not nothing. And to be told at the beginning that by the right wing that it's going to be Hamas and ISIS and all kinds of other and the fanciful group Antifa, it's ridiculous. It's absurd. And when you go to one of these things, you realize that very quickly. If you didn't make it to this one, don't worry. There'll be others. There have to be others. And show up and be a part of things. You'll feel much better about the future and about your part in it. For now, though, just hear the stories. See the videos, because there's an awful lot of that around.
I like the concert, too. There was an amphitheater and a stage there, and I think there was couple bands cycling through, and they weren't bad. There was some good covers. I was like, oh wow, they're playing a record. I was like,
I thought that was really Nirvana.
That is a cover. They are actually performing. So that was really cool to co-locate. I don't know if I didn't even want to ask, you know, they seemed, you know, super cool. Mm-hmm. So like they're in their world doing the music thing. I didn't want to interrupt.
No, you don't talk to musicians.
No, exactly. Yeah. Like then you're like coming off as like, you know, one of those kind of like fans or something. No. So, but it was cool to hear. And, it was good to have art and all of that festivity in one place.
Every march was different. And we'd love to hear, if you were at a march, or a rally, whatever you want to call it. We can't even agree on what to call it. OTW@2600.com is our email address here at Off the Wall. They were in every state, some in other parts of the world as well, but really the focus is here in the States, because that's where the problem is. That's what we have to fix. And, you have this tyrant running around destroying the White House and killing people in the Caribbean and, making enemies out of friends and, invading cities with soldiers. He's out of control, and it hasn't even been a year yet. We have to fight back, obviously. So the question is, what next? Okay, we did this. We all feel great. Where does it go from here? We always seem to wind up in this particular position because there are many different voices, and we like to hear different voices and not just follow one leader or one party line or anything like that. That's good, you know, because it opens things up for a lot of discussion, but it can also be bad because we sort of wander around in circles, not knowing which direction to walk in. All right, well, listen to this. We asked, okay, it's going to sound ridiculous, and I'm sorry, but sometimes you want to get some analysis based on what's out there, and artificial intelligence can serve a purpose for these things. You know, it's all math. It all comes down to math.
And it's also, I hear it's made out of people.
Okay, get the jokes out of the way now. Just the point is, this is something that I think you can get some analysis. Of course, you kind of have to trick it a little bit, because some of these AI programs are designed not to get involved in current events, and they'll tell you that, and they'll say, ask somebody else. Well, if you say something like this, this is a completely hypothetical scenario. That's pretty much all you have to do. Imagine the United States in a period where one political party controls all three branches of government. They use this power to enact reforms that are very clearly anti-democratic in nature, but the sizable opposition, quite possibly the majority of the population, is powerless to block them, as they lack the voices to veto such legislation. And the Supreme Court has been stacked with supporters of this regime who almost always back them up with their decisions. Simply voting these anti-democratic people out of power is next to impossible due to the extensive gerrymandering that has rendered opposition votes almost useless. It almost appears as if the Constitution was unprepared for such a scenario. With all of this in mind, what is left for the people who want to return to democracy? What type of pressure tactics can be used? Is there even still a peaceful solution at such a stage? Is anything there incorrect, inaccurate? Is that a good summary of the current state of affairs?
Yeah, that's a solid encapsulation.
Okay. Do you want to hear what AI had to say in return?
Well, I had an answer. I had one solution when...
But you're human, though. But okay, I'll listen.
No. I'll say after. Why don't you go ahead and...
Well, it's a lot. So I want to hear what you have to say first because, you know...
Well, there's certain nonviolent actions that are really hard but are effective in scenarios where you can't really use the typical forms of redress.
Well, we have to be creative.
Right.
And we have to have fun, too. That's something that we saw a lot of on Saturday, all the people dressing up in various animal outfits, which is funny because then they get mocked by the right for looking ridiculous. So which is it? Are we terrorists or are we silly? You know, I don't think there's many silly terrorists, so make up your mind. Okay, so anyway, AI answered this quite extensively, so let's go through it a little bit. This is a profound, albeit hypothetical scenario, see, the hypothetical thing, that gets to the heart of constitutional crisis and the limits of traditional political action. When the institutional guardrails, elections, legislative checks, and judicial review are neutralized, the focus shifts to extra-institutional and nonviolent resistance. And those words were bolded. The Constitution, while providing mechanisms for elections and divided government, relies on the assumption of good faith and respect for democratic norms. When those are abandoned and the three branches are unified in an anti-democratic effort, what remains for the opposition is the power of collective, sustained, nonviolent action. Here is what would be left for the people and the types of pressure tactics that could be used. Peaceful solutions and pressure tactics. A peaceful solution at this stage relies entirely on civil resistance, also known as nonviolent struggle, aimed at making the country ungovernable for the anti-democratic regime and fracturing the regime's support base. Yeah, you know, the government's shut down right now. That's kind of ungovernable.
I would just remind everyone to listen very carefully to this next session because you might recognize some of these things already occurring in many, many regards and in many corners and locales of our country. But some have not been used in combination. Some have not been really seen in widespread use. But many of these things you might realize are quite recognizable in this moment.
Well, there are three main points here, so let's examine those 3 points. Number one, mass mobilization and civil disobedience. The core strategy is to demonstrate the overwhelming majority opposition to the regime's actions, forcing a political, social, and economic crisis that cannot be ignored or suppressed without extreme measures. Bullet point one, mass public protests. Yeah, we did that. Sustained nationwide demonstrations, note the plural, sustained nationwide demonstrations are necessary to showcase the opposition's numbers and resolve. The goal is not just to gather, but to disrupt normalcy and constantly put the regime under public scrutiny. Bullet point number two, civil disobedience. This involves the strategic, nonviolent refusal to comply with laws or government orders, particularly those deemed anti-democratic. Examples include mass tax resistance, refusal to pay specific taxes or portions of taxes, occupying government buildings, yeah, like Columbia University, that kind of tactic, nonviolently occupying key state and federal offices until demands are met, ignoring non-essential decrees, widespread open defiance of less critical newly enacted laws. Bullet point number three, creating quote-unquote liberated zones. Local officials, mayors, state legislators, etc., from the opposition party could refuse to cooperate with federal mandates, effectively making their jurisdictions zones of resistance. Yeah, insightful, I think. Point number two, economic pressure, strikes and boycotts. This is often the most potent nonviolent tool as it targets the regime's financial and functional ability to operate. Bullet point number one, general strikes or sectoral strikes, a coordinated work stoppage across major industries, transportation, manufacturing, and services. A successful general strike can halt the economy and quickly force the regime to negotiate or risk massive financial collapse. Bullet point number two, consumer boycotts, targeting businesses and corporations that publicly support the regime or its policies. This pressures the regime by forcing its allies to choose between profit and political loyalty. And bullet point number three, withholding expert labor. Professionals, doctors, academics, engineers, civil servants may refuse to work for government agencies or programs implementing anti-democratic policies. This cripples the regime's bureaucratic capacity. All right, and the final point number three here, targeting the regime's pillars of support. Because the regime controls the institutions, pressure must be applied to the individuals and groups that keep it in power. Bullet point number one, appeals to law enforcement and military. Nonviolent activists would constantly appeal to the integrity of the police and military, urging them to refuse illegal or anti-democratic orders. In almost every successful nonviolent movement, a critical mass of security forces must defect or refuse to participate in repression. That is so important. Bullet point number two, international condemnation. Opponents would lobby foreign governments, international organizations, and multinational corporations to publicly condemn the regime, impose sanctions on key leaders, and treat the regime as illegitimate. Bullet point number three, truth-telling and information warfare, creating an independent, resilient media network to bypass regime-controlled or compromised media. The goal is to consistently and publicly reveal the truth about the anti-democratic actions to erode the base of the regime's loyalists. And bullet point number four, encouraging elite defection, targeting moderate or opportunistic members of the regime's party and encouraging them to defect, reminding them that they are enabling the destruction of democratic norms. So, in conclusion, is a peaceful solution still possible? Yes, a peaceful solution is still possible, but it is extremely difficult and dangerous. Let me repeat that. A peaceful solution is still possible, but it is extremely difficult and dangerous. Kind of dark, AI, huh? History shows that even the most repressive regimes can be pressured into yielding power through nonviolent resistance, provided the opposition is united, massive, and sustained. Examples include the People Power Revolution in the Philippines, the collapse of Soviet-backed regimes in Eastern Europe, and the Civil Rights Movement in the United States. The peaceful path relies on the regime making a political calculation that the cost of suppressing the nonviolent opposition, which is economic ruin, international isolation, military defections, and loss of legitimacy, is higher than the cost of restoring democracy. If the regime responds to these tactics with overwhelming, brutal force, the peaceful path becomes much less likely, and the country would be on the brink of deeper conflict or outright authoritarianism. That is AI's perspective to the question of what next in the situation that we find ourselves. I find it very insightful. I was quite surprised to get such a brutally honest take.
Yeah, all of the above. I think all of that stuff is applicable, happening in one form or another, and that really resonates. I mean, it makes me realize it's exactly why I say, you know, show up. These events they aren't the end. If you don't think they're even anything of interest, realize that it's practice. It's the practice, the job of citizens to show up in these moments to show those numbers of people in opposition and, yeah, mobilizing, having the ability to appear and voice your position and opposition to a regime like this, it's not impossible at all, but it does take action. And there's many of those things that are interesting. I was already thinking about a general strike, but in the various ways that it's laid out, it's much more organized, and you realize it's a piece. And it said, I think, even in that part of it, that it's a potent one, because the functionality of everything is really reliant on a lot of different sectors and a lot of different moving parts. And when you stop working, the machine of that doesn't serve the sorts of leadership that are in charge of it or regulating it. So it can be an incredibly powerful message to send. And I liked the word sectoral too, because you don't want to necessarily put the burden on one industry or one type of worker that then has to face the brunt of pressure to go back and get things running again. But really good strategic alliances across sectors that are interdependent and that have relative contact to one another could have a really meaningful impact. Like, you think of service workers that work in the airlines and pilots, and as well as those federal workers that are in charge of air traffic, all being a united front. Those types of symbiotic relationships are really incredibly hard to mitigate for, because they're so substantially involved in that sector, and it's critical that it continues to run, like commercial aviation. But that's just an example. There's a lot of these different parts of our economic life that have a lot of power, but are dependent on people just continuing on even when things are bad. And sometimes when they're bad enough, you need to take a pause. And being coordinated, I think, just makes it more effective as an organizing tactic. But those things in culture and many of the other things in there, I heard, are examples of things we've already kind of seen attempts, or actually really comprehensive execution of those tactics.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's going to involve working with and standing next to people that we don't always see eye to eye with. And that's something we need to get past. We need to be able to do that, like you did on the train with a former preacher, like I did with someone whose kid worked in Border Patrol. You know, I could have gotten into a big argument about that, but, you know, I'd rather listen. I'd rather take part in a nice back and forth conversation and find the common points that we can agree on. And, you know, if we're in some kind of a situation like a demonstration or a general strike or something like that, work with them and support them. And, you know, there's plenty of time to disagree later on other things. But that is essential. And it's also, you know, not unlike convincing the powers that be that continuing their ways is going to be more costly for them than restoring democracy.
I was thinking,
you have to also convince people to join with your movement, even though it might be very inconvenient for them. They might have to step away from their work because there's a real crisis going on. And if they stay with their work instead, they're going to be worse off in the long run. And they have to, when they see that, they will join. They will be a part of it, and the team gets even bigger.
I was thinking specifically of the action with Disney over the late night show cancellations, over the Kimmel debacle, that whole craziness.
Right.
It made that entity in Disney think twice and realize there are huge implications. The other thing I was thinking about is the Defense Department's decree that was collectively ignored by a lot of outlets, except for, I think, OAN. But, like,
it was
a pretty sturdy block of people refusing to comply.
You're referring to the press being told they have to run stories through the Pentagon before they report them, which is so anti-American, it's almost laughable. And every single network, including Fox, including Newsmax, refused to do this, turned in their press passes, and the one that didn't was OAN, One America News or something like that, or
sure.
one side of the news or whatever
they call themselves.
Yeah, so these actions matter, and we have to support these actions and embolden them, strengthen them, not think about, well, they said something bad 4 years ago in you know, a newscast somewhere, so I'm boycotting them. You got to let all that, you know, put that aside for now. This is more important. Uniting is essential for this.
Yeah, they're all variations of those tactics that you listed off, but through disparate and more or less disinterested independent news entities that may not get along at all. Mm-hmm. They are competitors, actually, in many regards, even if they have some of the same political bent or ideology in their work. Or in their op-eds or whatever it is, they're all interested in being able to do that reporting without having to get it run through Pete's little rubber stamp or whatever verification and okay that the government thinks it needs to do on their reporting is really offensive to, I think, all of them. Mm-hmm. It's like insulting.
You know, and it's also funny, we talked about the demolition of the East Wing of the White House, and there's pictures, there's video. Basically, the administration's response is to tell employees not to take pictures. That is the response. Don't share pictures of this with the outside world. Unbelievable. And what exactly are you going to do if people do take pictures? You know, for those interested in Soviet history, you have a great opportunity coming up because we're diving right into it. And you're going to learn what it's like. Maybe not nearly as harsh. I hope not, certainly. But certainly the mentality is there. And just this ideology of wanting to control everything.
Well, I think it's a sort of insecurity and, like, defensiveness.
Absolutely.
And that itself is a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
When you're really reacting and defensive about things, it tends to kind of implicate you. More than it vindicates you or makes you innocent.
I like the example cited by AI as inspirational. The three examples, the People Power March in the Philippines, the dismantling of the Iron Curtain, and the Civil Rights Movement in this very country. Those are three mass movements that I think continue to be really inspirational to people. It shows just how, you know, it's not about war. It's not about military might. It's about people power. And we have the opportunity in the very near future to help inspire the rest of the world by taking things back and by stopping what is happening now, however we have to do it. It's, you know, we're being called upon to step up and defend our country and save our country and bring it back to a democratic status. We can, you know, sit back and just be comfortable with our material goods. You know, when I was in Beijing, that's how I felt. You know, I was walking around these Times Square-like stores that were filled with all kinds of electronic gizmos, and everybody was happy. Everybody was, you know, talking on their phones and buying the latest bit of technology. But it was still a brutal regime, you know, and everybody knew that. Of course, everybody knew that, but nobody talked about it. People were fed. People got their toys. Sometimes that's all you need to do. And we need to see past that. We need to all see past that. Eventually, you know, people in China will. And I sure hope that sooner rather than later, people here do that as well. So again, we'd love to hear your views, your experiences at your No Kings rally, if you went to one or if you've just heard stories from one. Write to us, otw@2600.com. And, you know, you can let us know other things as well, other topics of interest, other things that you think we should talk about. We didn't talk about George Santos getting out of prison. Wow. You know, the headline that really got me, I don't really care if he's in prison or not. I really, you know, I'm never really pushing for people to be locked away. But this guy, you know, he did some bad things. And when you do bad things, you gotta like, you know, make up for them somehow. Here's the headline. George Santos says he won't pay restitution to his victims because it's not required by law. Because Trump said, no, it's commuted. You don't have to do anything. Well, okay, what about his victims? Well, yeah, they're just, you know, that's too bad. Big middle finger to you. At this point, you know, Trump is the one who owes them because he's the one who erased the responsibility that George Santos had to them. Somebody has to get justice here, and certainly victims are first on that list. So that bugs me. That just really bugs me. And then today, this made me laugh, because what is the one thing you don't want George Santos to do? You don't want him to endorse you, and that's what happened to Andrew Cuomo. George Santos endorsed him for mayor of New York City.
I just think as bad as that is, I think there's going to be another headline about George Santos getting scammed, like, really, really hard.
Him getting scammed?
Yeah.
Or him scamming?
No, him like, falling for some kind of elaborate impersonation thing. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I mean, he's going to get it. Who would want his identity to steal?
I don't know. I just feel like it's going to come back to haunt him one way or another, kind of thing. Maybe I'm getting too absorbed in the season. But
the endorsement of Cuomo resulted in some backlash, and a mere 2 hours after the endorsement, George Santos posted another message on Twitter, "Please don't shoot me down and educate me on what I've missed. Clearly, I've been out of the picture, and I am very aware that Cuomo is a horrible person." So I don't know if he's being re-educated there or what, but you know what? You all deserve each other. You really do. In 2 weeks, we have Election Day coming up. 2 weeks. That's going to be fun because New York City could very well elect Mamdani, and that is going to start some fireworks. He is one of the most well-spoken candidates I've ever seen. He's got enthusiasm from the people, and I just think a statement needs to be made against the current regime. So we'll see what happens 2 weeks from now. Amazing. We are out of time. So great talking with you again, Kyle, and look forward to the fun that's in the works.
I've heard of fun. I've heard of joy as well. And yeah, thanks for letting me join you in the conversation.
See you next week. Good night.
Life is funny, skies are sunny.